Well, I thank everyone for remaining calm today, keeping your seats, not going into a panic. The situation is largely under control. We have it mostly contained, but I do need to tell you that this whole area, this whole space, has been determined to be a bit of a hazard. You see, we have a leak. God is leaking out into the world. I'm very sorry. It's possible that you have all been infected. Infected by the God contagion. And the problem is, once infected, once this God gets out, we don't know how to stop it. In fact, we are powerless in the face of the presence of this God thing. We don't quite know what we're doing. We're trying very, very hard to rein the situation back in, to get it back under control, and we're confident that with enough time and resources that we'll be able to contain God once more. Because you see, the thing is that when God gets out, it's a frightening thing. It's a powerful thing, and we can't control it. We can't stop it. There's no telling how people will be affected when they come in contact with this God contagion. Some people seem to come in contact with God and walk away unchanged. They're fine. They go about their everyday lives and nothing has changed. And for other people, they come in contact with God and their lives are forever turned upside down and inside out, and they don't know which way is up anymore. Their lives will never be the same in ways we can't predict. I mean, it's horrible. It's horrible because we're not in control of it, and it is out there running wild in the world, this God thing. And we have got to get it contained again. Now, we laugh because that's really silly. But that's exactly what we've been doing for millennia. That's the story of humanity's relationship with God going back centuries upon centuries. Fear. God is powerful, so protect yourself. Hide away, because we don't know what's going to happen, and we're not in control of what happens when God breaks loose. And so we would rather try to separate ourselves back away a little bit. That's kind of what's going on with Moses and the Israelites, right? This story from Exodus. Moses goes up on the mountain, and he doesn't know what's going on, you know, that what he looks like. He's just talking to God. So he goes up on the mountain and he talks to God and he gets, you know, 10 commandments and a whole bunch of laws and things to bring back to the people. And he comes down off the mountain and his face is shining. The people are like, whoa, dude, put that away. I mean, we want to hear what God has to say. So tell us that. And you can tell us that even with your face all shiny like that, because it helps us know that it's God talking. But then cover that up. Because when God time is done, you've got to put that away. We can't have the presence, the glory of God shining in our midst all the time. We'll go nuts. It's too much. There's too much God. We can't handle it. Put it away. Put that away. Because you see, God can be really frightening, can be really dangerous, can be uncontrolled. In C.S. Lewis's story, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, which is filled with a lot of questionable theology, so I don't endorse all of the overall read of the theology, but one of the children, Lucy, asks Mr. and Mrs. Beaver. They're kind of having a meal together, and the animals have been telling them about Aslan, the lion, who is the very thinly veiled metaphor for Jesus in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And Lucy asks, is Aslan safe? And Mr. Beaver says, haven't you been listening? Of course Aslan isn't safe. Aslan's a lion, for crying out loud, people. No, Aslan is not safe. Aslan is good, and Aslan is the king. But Aslan is not safe. God's not supposed to be safe. God is not supposed to be contained. God is not supposed to be hidden behind a veil. But we'd like to think that. And we'll say that the reason we do things like that is to keep God holy. Right? The reason we separate ourselves from God is to keep God holy. I don't think God needs any help being or remaining holy. God's got that part covered. I suspect that it's more to keep ourselves more comfortable. You see, the veil idea gets built into the architecture of the temple when the temple's constructed. And then when it's destroyed and constructed again, it's still there, built into the very architecture of the temple. The Holy of Holies, which is the seat where God's presence rests while on earth, right? It's sort of the throne of God, the place where God is most present. The Holy of Holies is contained in the very inner sanctuary of the temple in Jerusalem. It's kind of like a nesting doll, right? There are outer courts and inner courts and outer sanctuaries and inner sanctuaries, in all the way to the deepest recess. And that's where the Holy of Holies is, where God's presence is. And only the high priest can go there. And the Holy of Holies is separated from the rest of the world by a curtain, a veil, to keep God holy or to keep the rest of the world safe. Now, Jesus came, lived, taught, died, rose, in large part to teach us that these barriers that we construct are ours and not God's. And that these barriers that we construct are not necessary, but that we can stand before God on our own. As terrifying, as knee-knockingly terrifying as that it is us and God, that we need no high priest, we need no inner sanctuary, we need no place or intercessor to protect us from God, not that anything could, or to protect God from us, but that we are before our God as we are. And as frightening as that is, that's what Jesus taught. At the moment of his death, that curtain in the temple was torn in two, the Gospels report, from the top to the bottom. As I've mentioned before, that means two things. That means, you know, top to bottom, the whole kit and caboodle, the whole curtain torn apart. And it means, in a worldview where God is up and we are down, it means from God to us, by God's own action, that temple, just curtain, just torn in two, the barrier, completely leveled, completely blown away. Now, Jesus reveals a little bit of this in the story that we heard about the Transfiguration. He lifts just a little corner of the veil, and Peter and James and John get a glimpse of who he is and a glimpse of what he's about and what's about to happen. And it terrifies them, and they don't understand. Peter didn't know what he was talking about. Poor Peter, he gets that line all the time. He didn't know what he was talking about. But they get just this little glimpse of who Jesus is and what he's going to mean and what, you know, what the next chapter of the journey is going to be about. And their first reaction is, let's build a building. Let's contain it. We'll build three buildings. In fact, we'll build one for Elijah and one for Moses and one for Jesus. And we're going to build them up here on the mountain where we can visit them on our time and on our terms whenever we want, and we don't have to stay there, and they're going to stay up there, and we're going to go back to our lives, but we're going to contain it. That's our reaction. Veil that off, curtain it off, build a structure, hide it away, get some caution tape out, and tape off anything that has everything to do with God, because it's dangerous, and it is frightening, and it is life-changing, so let's contain it. And Jesus' death reveals that in that wonderful metaphor of the curtain ripping, that God is doing away with that. That we are before God, just as we are. That God is loose in the world, running wild, running amok, messing with our plans, messing with our neat categories, messing stuff up. And that's just the way of it. For a little while. The early church was a scary, frightening place to be. I mean, they had no structure. They were just people who had God shining on their faces. There were people running wild all over the place. They met in each other's houses, wherever they could find the space. And they did what they believed God called them to do. If they felt like preaching, they preached. If they felt like healing somebody, they healed somebody. If they felt the Spirit moving in a particular direction, they went with it. But you know, there got to be more and more of them, so they needed a bigger place to meet, so they started building structures. Little buildings and bigger buildings and places that were more designated for God's space. Then they did something really, truly horrifying, just terrible, very bad idea. They developed clergy. Bad thing. Bad move. I mean, it starts out okay. people to administer sacraments, people to lead in ministries of healing or ministries of service or however they felt called, right? But more and more, the longer these clergy folks stick around, the more they begin to develop a role kind of like Moses, a role of professional intercessor on behalf of the people to God and on behalf of God to the people. That's what a clergy person is, right? I mean, that's why you pay me, so I talk to God, and then I come back and I tell you what God said, so you all don't have to do that, right? Thanks for playing. Guess again. But that's what clergy begin to function as. It's an extra layer of structure. We can get even more structured and hierarchical. We'll get ourselves a pope. Now the pope will talk to God, and the pope will tell the clergy what God said, and the clergy will tell the people what the pope said God said, and the people are nice and safe, like 6 degrees of separation removed from God. Every once in a while, someone comes along and says, this isn't right. Wait a minute, this isn't what Jesus was talking about. He says that we can just stand before God as we are. We don't need these rituals and intercessors and buildings and structures to contain God. We can just let God out or let God in. So you get a reformation here and a new movement there. John Wesley, the founder of the Methodist movement, said, oh, you know, this priest thing is great. The Sunday morning thing is great, but me and my friends are going to also seek God during the week. And you know, we're going to seek God in the faces of the poor and the oppressed and the widows and the orphans and the incarcerated and the sick. And we're going to reach out to them in service, and that's going to be part of our God experience out there in the world. It's a good movement. And it gets built up more and more structured, more and more contained, more and more defined. It's our nature. It's kind of what we do. And every once in a while, someone comes along and tears down some walls and rips some curtains a little bit and lifts the veil just a touch so that we can get a glimpse and let God roam wild for a little while. And then we'll very cautiously curtain God back off to where we think God belongs. We try to contain God in all sorts of ways, try to keep God inside our building, just like Peter wanted to do on the mountain, because if we can keep God inside the church building, then we visit God on our terms, when we feel like it, at a set time, and then we go home. And we're done with that God thing for a little while. And we'll contain God in 60 minutes, no more, Pastor, than 60 minutes, which means I needed to stop preaching 25 seconds ago, because that's God time. And the other 6.5 plus days a week, that's my time. I got Olympics to watch. I got naps to take. There are things to do. And keep God contained. We keep God contained in very nice, concise, well-written, neatly organized prayers. Why? Because I only have this piece of paper to fit them all on. So I want a 4-line call to worship. If it's going to be 6 lines, then they need to be short. 6 lines, because that's all the room I have, so call response, call response. The opening prayer needs to be able to fit in the space allotted, or even more importantly, needs to be able to fit on the screen in 36-point font so everybody can read it, and I'd prefer not to have to have a click in the middle of the prayer to the next slide, because it's a little distracting. So, preferably shorter. Contain God in our hymns, not too many verses of hymns. We don't want to be singing for too long. And we want to make sure we all sing the same tunes to our hymns, and we all sing the same words to our hymns, and we all say the same words to our prayers, especially the Lord's Prayer. Heaven forbid we get a different kind of Protestant up in here who says, you know, debts and debtors, or sins and sin against us instead of trespasses. I mean, then it's like chaos in here. Life with God is a little bit messy, and so we try to clean it up a bit. Now, Soren Kierkegaard is one of my top 3 favorite theologians of all time. And yes, I'm an incredible dork. I rank my favorite theologians. But Kierkegaard wrote in an excerpt from his journal, this is in the 19th century, he writes about the Christian faith and our tendency to try to sanitize it and make it safe. He says, the matter's quite simple. The Bible is very easy to understand, but we Christians are a bunch of scheming swindlers. Guess we haven't changed too much. We pretend to be unable to understand the Bible because we know very well that the minute we understand, we are obliged to act accordingly. Take any words in the New Testament and forget everything except pledging yourself to act accordingly. My God, you will say, if I do that, my whole life will be ruined. How would I ever get on in the world? Herein lies the real place of Christian scholarship. Christian scholarship is the church's prodigious invention to defend itself against the Bible, to ensure that we can continue to be good Christians without the Bible coming too close. Oh, priceless scholarship, what would we do without you? Dreadful it is to fall into the hands of the living God. Said another way, by a young man named Shane Claiborne, who's the author of this really phenomenal book that I love called The Irresistible Revolution. And Shane is writing about trying to follow Jesus, real radical stuff, not necessarily trying to do church, trying to follow Jesus and what that might mean. And he has a little section toward the beginning that's called Jesus Wrecked My Life. And he talks about how, you know, he used to be cool. When he was in high school, he was the prom king. He thought about, you know, he wanted to get the best job he could, make the most money for the least effort. He determined that that would be anesthesiologist, because you put people to sleep with a little bit of gas, and then somebody else comes in and does all the hard work. You make a lot of money, and you can buy lots of stuff, and that's the American dream. Shane writes, I know there are people out there who say, my life was such a mess. I was drinking, partying, sleeping around, and then I met Jesus and my whole life came together. God bless those people. But me, I had it together. I used to be cool. And then I met Jesus and he wrecked my life. The more I read the gospel, the more it messed me up, turning everything I believed in, valued, and hoped for upside down. I'm still recovering from my conversion. God's dangerous stuff. Ruins our plans, messes with our values, tells us that what we've been chasing after is for nothing and that we need to look for the simple things or for the godly things. And when God goes wild in the world and gets out there running amok, turning things upside down, making a mess of life, we are utterly powerless. And that's probably the most frightening thing of all. We're not in control. We hate that. So we are terrified of what it means to let God run amok in the world. But despite that terror, I believe we're ready for it. In fact, I believe we need it. Anybody else believe that? One. Oh, good. Okay. I'm going to have to start over here, folks. Okay. Believe that we're ready to let God out or let God in. Who believes that? That we can break down the walls. All right, now I see some hands. I need a volunteer, at least. Come on up, Stephanie. We're going to let God out. If you would give me a hand. Give us a cut. There we go. Let God out in the world. Thank you. Anybody else? We're letting God out. Come on up, Marie. Let God out into the world. God won't be held back, won't be controlled. Where would you like? How about the cross? Let that cross go. Amen to that. Who else? You see, I believe that this is scary. This isn't easy. This isn't, here we go. We got a couple coming up. There we go. Find yourself some tape to cut. It isn't easy, it isn't safe. Thank you for not getting the curtain. We don't want to be too literal about tearing down curtains that the church has. I did say rip down curtains. I didn't mean that one. It might be scary, it might not be safe, it might pull us out of our comfort zones. We're going to free the pulpit if that's all right. But it also is what we are called to do. Now, the rest of you who didn't come up here are not out of the woods yet, because you all have a piece of caution tape in your bulletin. Some of them get a little cut off. It's not California tape or no tape if you turn it upside down. It's caution tape. And I want you to think of this caution tape as representing whatever it is that is a barrier between you and God. I don't know who put it there. Maybe you put it there. Maybe the church put it there. Maybe I put it there. Maybe God, is being revealed to you or taught to you in a way that is holding you back, but I can guarantee that God didn't put the barrier there and that God doesn't need the barrier to be there. God doesn't want the barrier to be there. But whatever is holding you back, a way of thinking about God, a fear about what it might mean to take a leap and to step forward in that, confining God to a worship time or place rather than, all of the time and all of the places, whatever it is that's kind of separating you or holding you back a little bit, keeping you cautious, I want you to consider that caution tape to represent that. And as we enter the Lenten season, I don't want you to give up chocolate. I'd be the last person in the world to advocate giving up chocolate. I want you to give up red meat or fatty foods or swearing or television. Not that you're not going to live much more fulfilled, wonderful, healthy lives if you do give up those things. So you can give them up too, except the chocolate. But I want you to consider and pray about and prepare for giving up that thing or things that hold you back, that are barriers between you and God, or between God and the rest of the world out there. And I want you to give it up for 40 days. I want you to give it up for 40 years, 50, 60, 70. Does that cover just about everybody? For as long as it takes to let go of those things that hold us back, because that's what Jesus was about. Jesus was about us and God, in relationship with one another. No intercessors, no barriers, no things holding God back or holding us back, no trying to contain or sanitize or make safe the God who is complete, unhindered, unbridled force of life out there in the world. We can't hold that back. Now, I'd like to tell you that the situation is under control. No, I wouldn't. I'd like to tell you that the situation is uncontrolled, that God is running wild everywhere, and that everyone sees it. The contagion has spread, and people are just shining with the presence of God, but that's not entirely true either, because we have been largely successful in containing God in some ways. We as churches have been pretty successful in holding God in for ourselves rather than letting God out. And that's not our job. Our job is to tear down walls, to cut caution tape, to lift or rip veils, to remove the barriers between us and God and between the rest of the world and God, because God didn't put them there. God calls us to take them down. So get your scissors for cutting the tape. Get your hands for ripping or lifting veils. Get your hammers and your pickaxes for tearing down walls, because we are a people infected by God, and we are a people who are about the news of spreading the God contagion. Let it run amok. Amen.